Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Still, I note, no dog.
No dog, no, no. We have a fox, though, in my garden, right? Is that...
Oh, that doesn't count as
a pet. Does that not count?
This week on Walking the Dog, Ray and I went out for a West London stroll with legendary comedian Al Murray. Al is obviously best known for his hugely popular character, the pub landlord, but he's also a very respected historian with a fascinating backstory of his own as the great-great-great-grandson of Vanity Fair author William Makepeace Thackeray. So I could frankly listen to this man talk about his life all day. We had the loveliest chat about everything from the family passion for Labradors to his slightly challenging days at boarding school and the birth of his incredibly successful comedy career. Al, as you may know, also has his own podcast centred around the Second World War with historian James Holland, which I thoroughly recommend you listen to. And he's also written a brilliant book, Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War, which I really loved. And by the way, you can go and see Al touring this year as the pub landlord in Gove Island. To book tickets, go to thepublandlord.com. I'm going to stop talking now and hand over to the man himself. Here's Al and Ray Ray.
So the park's through that way, isn't it?
Should we go this way?
Yeah.
Al, do you want to get a coffee for our walk?
No, I'm right. I've just drunk a big pot of coffee.
Do you mind if I get one?
You get a coffee.
Will that be annoying?
No, no, it'd be totally cool.
Al, can I get you a coffee?
Yeah, all right, yeah. Can I have a decaf flat white, please?
Decaf flat white?
Yeah.
And?
I'm going to have a calf flat white.
Yeah, fine.
I live on the edge, unlike my
friend. Well, no, I've just, like I said, I've just drunk a gallon of coffee, so.
I love it around here. It's so villagey.
It is very villagey. No, we came for fireworks in November in the park, but they got a laser show instead of fireworks.
Oh, it's gone a bit Jean-Michel Jarre.
Well, let me tell you, if that's the future, I'm not having it. You know, like just some lamps, and they had the Star Wars music, and it lit up some trees, but it didn't light up the night sky, and nothing went bang, and it felt not good.
What would the pub landlord say?
Oh, another clear sign that the country's done, cooked, finished.
First they take our fireworks.
Well, exactly. Well, you know, and fireworks are to celebrate the, you know, catching a Catholic terrorist. It's right up his street.
Frank Skinner finds that day very offensive.
Oh, of course he does. He's got to find something offensive, hasn't he?
Oh, wow, my coffee's got a little heart on it.
Well, that's sweet, isn't it? Wonder what I'm going to get.
Right, I'm following you, Al Murray.
So there's a indoor bouldering rock climbing place here. I mean, that could be your next podcast. You have to climb a wall with Emily Dean. See who gets to the top first, like gladiators or something.
Right, follow Al. He knows where he's going.
We'll cut through here and we end up in the park.
Oh, this is lovely. So this is your manor, Al, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yeah. And I've lived around here for a really long time as well. One of my daughters used to go to a nursery called Happy Times, where once I went in, she'd bitten someone, so that wasn't a particularly happy time, right? She'll be delighted I've remembered that. She was stood in the corner. You know when little kids, they know they've done something wrong, and they stand in a corner, and you could see the air around them is going, I know I'm in trouble. I can't remember who she bit, but she bit someone over, because over there's a big... sort of Art Deco hospital, 1920s hospital, Ravens Court Park Hospital. The nurse used to be in there, and you'd go in, a really nice, really lovely place, but my main memory of it is her standing in the corner, sort of glaring, knowing she was in trouble. Fantastic.
Happy memories of happy times.
Yeah.
It's great that it was called Happy
Times.
Yeah,
it's perfect, really.
So this is Ravens Court Park.
This is Ravens Court Park.
Which is kind of near Chiswick, isn't it? Is it?
Yes, it's halfway, sort of, halfway between Chiswick and Hammersmith. This is strictly speaking Hammersmith. And there's tennis here, and then there's fireworks in the autumn, and they do stuff in the park in the summer, I think, as well.
I like this, Al. I feel like you're sort of Foxton's estate agent selling me the land.
Well, yeah, if I were trying to sell it, I'd tell you it was in Chiswick, not Hammersmith. Oh, Fulham Borders.
So I am, of course, with the very wonderful Al Murray, comedian, podcaster, drummer, author, highly respected historian.
Oh, steady.
Is there no end to your talents?
Well, yeah, they're all side hustles, is the way I look at it. And sometimes the comedy's the side hustle, and sometimes the history's the podcasting and the history, which are the tied up in, together are the side hustle. And so I'm on tour at the moment, but we're doing weekends only with the stand-up. And then the rest of the week, I'm trying to finish a book, and a history book, which is... I'm really good at pitching books, Emily. I'm brilliant at it, right? I go in, I see an editor, and I go, what no one's written is a book approaching this well-known topic and well-worn topic from a completely, from a fresh angle. There have been two attempts, but trust me. And then 4 months later, I'm thinking, Christ, why have I painted myself into this corner? But
My best friend Jane Goldman, who you know, who's a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And whenever I'm struggling with writing, she says, do you know what, Em? No one likes writing. Everyone loves having written.
Yes. I think that's probably true. Although I have this real agony with books that they're in black and white and you can't alter them. Whereas stand-up, you know, I'll go back to the show at the weekend and I go, that bit needs changing, or I'll take that bit out, or, you know, or I need to speed this up or slow this down. Whereas particularly a history book, it's in black and white, and I know there's going to be a load of people pop up and go, you missed this out. Why? You've got that wrong. I disagree with you. I mean, I don't know if people disagree with me about things, but like the actual sort of granular detail, because I'm writing about one day rather than a... So I'm trying to just reframe a whole event through
one
day.
Don't call it one day, because that's going to cause a lot of confusion.
It's not called that, don't worry. Okay. It's not called one day. And there's nothing romantic about this. It's tragic, but it's not romantic, the book I'm writing. But no, it's this thing. I'm brilliant at, I can pitch books. If you need a book pitched, I'll go in and do it for you, as long as I don't have to write the fucking thing.
Well, Al, I'm so thrilled you've met with us today. I should say we're in... Ravenscourt Park in West London. I have Raymond with me. You have previous form on this podcast.
Yes.
And still, I note, no dog.
No dog, no. We have a fox, though, in my garden, right? Is that...
Al, that doesn't count as
a pet.
Does
that not count? No, so we went away for New Year for the holiday. When we got back, there were two burrows dug under our fence to next door, two escape routes, I imagine they are. And then the fox had also tried a third one against this concrete wall that runs, our back wall, which runs down many, many metres.
Yeah.
And he'd obviously, or she'd had a go at digging through that, gave up. But this morning, next door's cat and the fox were chasing each other through the garden, came over the fence and then back under the... So I've not got a dog, but I've got a fox with a limp.
Have you got a fox, though, Al?
Well, I think that as near as... That's like having a pet in London.
You're going for the possession is...
Yeah, exactly. Or seeing the fox every morning is 9/10 of the law.
Yeah.
You know, there are some people who have dogs who don't see them that much.
You did have dogs growing up. You were very much a Labrador family,
weren't
you?
Yeah. My dad was always very, very doggy. And there was Spike. Before Spike, there was Nuts, there was Spike...
Nuts. I don't know about Nuts.
Nuts was the first dog. There was Nuts, Spike, Bella. Oh God! You know what? I'm glad you got your poo bags.
Why?
Chiswick is absolutely diabolical for dog shit. I sometimes post on Twitter about it because it's.
It's so, you know, people also do this thing where they'll put it in a bag and then leave the bag somewhere.
I know, no, we have every variation, but there was a thing the other day
let's check.
A huge pile of dog turds, but with a packet of cigarettes in them. But there you go, Emily.
Oh, thank you.
It's behind you.
In the world's worst panto.
Dog poo panto. Dick Shittington, yeah.
So yeah, so you had labs because
yeah,
that's exactly what I would have expected.
Well,
of
I mean, we're my family of Labrador type people. Yeah, very much so.
And what is Labrador type people?
Oh, my parents lived in the countryside. They're middle class, in the higher end of middle class, I think it's fair to say. And just Labradors are. My dad also, he likes long walks. Always loved long walks. It's not as mobile as he was, but he's a long walk guy, and a Labrador, that's what you want for a 5 mile, you know, down to the ford and back and all that sort of thing that he'd do of a Saturday morning. So, yeah.
And this was in sort of Buckinghamshire, ooh, was it?
And yeah, North Buckinghamshire, yeah.
People always refer to you as being posh.
Yeah.
And as you said, it wasn't really. There's posh and there's posh.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, there's posh and there's posh. And there's I mean, my you know, my pedigree, if that's what you're looking at,
yeah,
is certainly posh. But we weren't, you know, I always think one of the interesting things about public school that people who look on public school from outside don't realise is how there's a wide variety, you know, and there are the people in top hats and canes, and then there are there are other very different places with quite a different sort of catchment and, you know, values and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's... we are posh, but we're not that posh, I think it's fair to say. And my dad was, you know, basically a civil servant. He worked for the railway his whole life. So you know, it's not like we were trading on it or whatever.
You weren't Bullingdon.
No. And I never knew any of those. When I went to Oxford University, I never knew any of those people. You never encountered them, you know, because we were in our little group and never ran into any of those people.
Look at these little sausage
gorgeous,
dogs.
Aren't they? Cute.
Have you ever seen such tiny legs?
I like the different coloured collars, so they're colour-coded sausage dogs. They're colour-coded sausage dogs. I love it.
I can tell the difference between them, but I think it does make life a bit easier.
I can imagine it does, yeah.
What are their names?
So that's Dimples, that's Doris, and that's Daphne.
I love it.
All D names.
Dimples, Doris, and Daphne. Fantastic. Oh, they're really cute.
When I'm shouting after, I go, Doris, I mean Dimples, I mean Daphne.
Oh, I love it. Oh,
Lovely to meet you.
Yeah, and your dogs.
Yeah, so...
Go on, what's the...
I think the reason people leap to this conclusion that you're sort of Downton Abbey or something...
Yeah.
...is because of your very famous ancestor.
Yeah.
Because you have a very famous literary ancestor. I'm going to force you to repeat
William Thackeray. William Makepeace Thackeray, author of Vanity Fair and Barry Lyndon and Penn Dennis and... the Yellow Plush Papers, and he was a cartoonist and a punch writer and all that stuff. Yeah, and sort of, he was kind of like, I'm trying to think of the right analogy, because, you know, that he was contemporary with Dickens, who was basically the world's most famous author, colossal bestseller, and then there was Thackeray. And it's kind of like, it's not like the Beatles and the Stones, it's like the Beatles, and there are no other bands. And then there's him sort of... There's a story that...
And was he famous and successful in his life?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But he never had the success that Dickens did. He never quite... It's quite interesting. His life was one of... and sometimes, you know, hard relate to this. He was a very, very successful... writer, like journalist, really, rather than a novelist. It's quite interesting. He was a really, really successful writer and a brilliant satirist and really good at skewering stuff. And then he wrote Vanity Fair, and he wrote that on a kind of like, you know, they all wrote those books sequentially.
It was sort of pamphlets or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Released
so it's the Cornhill Gazette, I think, was the thing he published Vanity Fair. And I might be wrong about that. My mum will go, oh, for God's sake, will you never learn this history? But anyway... And it was in instalments, and he committed to writing 7, and then the whole idea is if it's a hit, then you write the rest of the novel, right? So he starts writing it, and it takes off, and it's a hit and everything, and it's really, really like well-received and really critically acclaimed. But what it isn't quite is a bestseller, or it's a bestseller, but not like a, it's not Pickwick Papers.
Yeah.
And so he then spends the rest of his life trying to write the one book that means he can basically, like, relax and get past the, you know, get to the point of being able to chill out about the whole thing. And it never happens. And so sometimes you think, yeah, I can see that. You have a good run or you get a project away and then you think, all I need is one more project that actually tips completely and everything.
I just want my Dan Brown
exactly
in the bank.
Exactly, exactly. And he's really interesting because he's in lots of ways. He is a hack because he has to write for a living. As his wife suffered postpartum depression, tried to kill herself, and he had to put her into caring accommodation. And she went to a mental hospital in... We go that way, yeah. Mental hospital in Paris, where they had all the latest cures and all this sort of stuff, and he and she ended up in the end, I think, living in Southend, like with a carer. So he had to bring up his two daughters by himself. His family life is quite difficult, and he was having to write at the same time, and he had an inheritance that he gambled away when he was at Cambridge, like basically in a term because he's an idiot. And so his life is an interesting one, but there's Charles Dickens as well.
Were your family sort of proud of that association?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I had a great aunt who was very much the sort of keeper of the flame. And, you know, because the thing is, there's a whole load of Thackeray history that, you know, no one really knows what company he kept as a literary man of London, famous literary man of London. With his wife sort of unwell.
Mm.
And my great aunt didn't want to hear anything about who he might have been hanging out with in clubbable London or that sort of thing.
She went a bit high since Bouquet, honestly.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And you would pay him to come to dinner and he'd come to your dinner party and
that's like you doing corporates.
It is. It's exactly like that, yeah. It's exactly like doing corporates. Or after dinner speaking. But you'd pay him to come round in the evening and he'd get drunk and he'd be witty and garrulous and all that sort of thing. It's, you know, different world but completely the same, you know what I mean?
So fascinating. I wonder what he'd make of you doing what you do. I reckon he'd be quite proud. You're continuing the satirical tradition.
Well, my great aunt used to call me the satirist, you know. That was her way of sort of getting over the fact I, you know, would swear at strangers in rooms above pubs when I first started out. But yeah, I mean, she did see it in that kind of in that vein, which is nice.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You've told me a bit about your family and I have a really lovely sort of idea of them because you once said that they had a kind of light touch.
Yeah.
What do you mean exactly by that?
My parents had a really, they had a fantastic light. I remember one time in my lower six where I'd not been really applying myself at school. My dad sat me down and said, look, I've read your report, but I can't come the heavy father with you. I'm not interested in doing that. But you know, you do need to get your finger out, and that was kind of the extent of it.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, I think the school they sent me to and the education I had, the expectation wasn't that I would end up doing what I'm doing. But there was never a, like, you know, when are you gonna knuckle down and take life seriously conversation. That never, none of that ever happened. I think about it. I do think about the time when I started out, and you know, all my generation of comics started out, you know, because I did, I was incredibly, you know, I mean, I do have the privilege of my upbringing and where I went to university, all that sort of stuff. But the real privilege we had when we were starting out coming to London is you signed on and you got housing benefit and London was affordable.
Because your trajectory, you know, you went from, it's quite a posh boarding school, but you were...
I should have been a lawyer or something, or gone into the city or something. I remember going for a job job interview. So I think a friend of mine, a college friend of mine, kind of became a headhunter, and she said, can I put you up for some things? I went, all right. And I remember going for a job at some city insurance firm, you know, where they were insuring financial liabilities and all this sort of thing. And in the interview thinking, I have absolutely no idea what you people do. And sometimes when I have no idea about something, I'll then become curious about it, right? And go, well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard of that. And nothing they said in the interview could convince me I want to do it. And they said, well, what do you really want to do? I said, well, I want to be a stand-up comedian. So I'd probably gig in the evenings if I was doing this. You could see them thinking, this guy is here to waste our time and nothing else. So, you know.
I'm interested, as a kid, you've talked about boarding school as well. I know Charles Spencer's actually just written this book about boarding school, hasn't he?
Yeah.
It seems like it's sort of a bit of a hot topic at the moment.
Yeah.
What are your views on it, looking back? What were the sort of drawbacks to being there?
God, I remember when I first went, absolutely, it made me really sad and really upset and being away from my family. I found that all very... really didn't like it, and I'd say write to my parents like 2-3 times a week, going, you know, why, I can't stand it and everything, and I didn't like it, and I wasn't cut out for it at all when I was small, when I first started. And you know, there were reasons I went, but I don't know if they were good enough reasons now I look back at it, really. It's 50 years ago nearly, so it's a long time ago. So the world has changed, but I think the fundamental thing of being away from your family isn't any different if you were to do it now.
And it does. It sort of shapes you, doesn't it? That experience.
Yeah, completely. How could that experience not shape you and turn you into a kind of person? I mean, what we didn't have, or as far as I know, we didn't have at my boarding school, was, you know, sexual abuse and the stuff that. Al Spencer's been talking about, but you did, you know, it. Everyone's away from their families, and obviously there's a giant flock of pigeons here.
That was pigeons, by the way.
Fantastic. And the old moorhen.
You see, Al, I might have known if anyone was going to be able to single out a bird like that. He's like Wikipedia. I couldn't tell you what a moorhen was.
I think they're the black things with the red. Front of their head and beak.
The ones with the green faces.
That's like a mallard, right?
You see...
That's your standard... That's like a duck, isn't it? If it's got a Latin name, it's called Duccus duccus. It's, you know what I mean?
It's like a Fisher Price duck.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly. It's the first duck you think of. When the psychologist says to you, whatever you do, don't think of a duck, that's the duck you think of.
I'm going to say they're a bit basic.
Yeah, they're basic ducks. Basic W6 duck.
But that's so interesting. It's interesting what you're saying about boarding school, because you're right. I can see how those things would stay with you, because you're such a sponge when you're that age.
Yeah.
And do you think it's made you more emotionally resilient, but perhaps a little bit more buttoned up?
I think it's done both of those things. I think it, you know, it equips you for being buttoned up, and for using that if you need to use that. But I mean, it is. But I think, you know, we're meant to talk about everything now, and I don't know. I still don't know if that's right. Still, instinctively, I'm not sure that that's actually. Sometimes. If you've got a problem, the best thing to do is shut up about it. not tell everybody and not burden everyone with it. Just shut up about it. Because sometimes you can talk yourself into, I think it is possible sometimes to talk yourself into a worse place if you talk about a problem too much. And so I don't know. I mean, you know, certainly. I've never been for therapy, but I think it would be. I think I'd, because I do like talking about myself as well. So that's the egotist of the comedian, you know, in the end, that you like being the centre of attention and all that stuff that goes with the job, you know, or the motivations for the job at least, I think.
But therapy is. It requires stripping down a lot of layers, I suppose.
Yeah.
Would you feel comfortable with that?
Probably not, you see. Probably not, you know. And I'd wonder in the end if it were necessary, is the thing. You know, maybe the sort of, it's too late. It's just too late. I am the calcified, like a calcified central heating system, you know, it's too late. You'll never get the fur out of my veins or something. I don't know.
Interestingly, because everyone would look at you in a hugely successful career you've had and are continuing to have and assume you were a noisy, charismatic extrovert who owned rooms. And that's really, doesn't seem like that was the case.
No, not really. And it's certainly not. I mean, the thing is always with this, you know, we'd need to call some witnesses but certainly that's never how I felt about anything because there is that. I think one of the things I felt about boarding schools, you kind of feel like you've had the rug pulled out from under you because you've been set, you're away from home and you're away from your family. And so, and also, I mean, the other thing about boarding school, I think it's interesting because now, you know, they're all in their own rooms now and all sorts of stuff. And we were in dormitories and, you know, you put 10, 11-year-old boys in a room together, there's going to be ruthless pecking order stuff going on all the time.
Lord of the Flies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lord of the Flies, he put the end of the world into that to make them fight with each other. I mean, we didn't need that. we didn't need a nuclear explosion to make us treat each other appallingly, you know. We were well set for that anyway. Let's go this way. And anyway, so I wasn't sporty, and I think what was interesting at school is a lot of people, you know, being sporty gave them a framework for you know, you play games, you get on the team, you know, all this sort of stuff. I've not seen this before.
What is this, Al? Do you want to read it out?
It's a memorial stone with the old Solidarność, the old Solidarity logo on it. In memory of Giles Vernon Hart, lifelong campaigner of freedom and human rights, honoured by NSZ's Solidarność as one who supported Poland in her hour of need, born on the 20th of November 1949, killed in the Tavistock Square bombing.
Aww.
On the 7th of July 2005. Be the change you want to be in this you want to see in this world, Mahatma Gandhi. Gosh. Whereas the Polish Centre is just around the corner from here, the big Polish Centre, and there were lots of Poles in West London after the war.
How lovely, you know what I love? It's so sad, but it says this person died in 2005, obviously, in the Tavistock Square bombing, and there's fresh flowers.
There's fresh flowers, yeah.
And I love that. I love the idea that there's still someone, you know, coming to see them. Oh,
gosh.
How moving.
A bit of history there.
So, yeah, sorry, you were saying...
And I wasn't sporty, so I think I was, you know, bright, but you're looking for places to be confident in.
Mm.
I used to be terribly, terribly self-conscious when I got into my early teens.
Did you?
Appallingly self-conscious. And so you end up, so I ended up sort of thinking, well, I fancy acting, because then you're performing, and then you've got control of the being self-conscious. You're like occupying it and making it work for you. And that I think is how I ended up in the end being a comic. And we had a drama teacher at school who was brilliant, and it's a bunch of us who he encouraged, and who, funnily enough, suddenly crops up, you know, something like, oh, I just ran into your old drama teacher, and, you know, and I always say to them, tell him it's all his fault, you know, like, Don't let him get away with being nostalgic. It's all his fault. You know, there were a group of us and we got together and we would skive off games, a whole bunch of us, and hide in, a bit of the school together and play music together and hang out and did plays together and all that sort of stuff. And that's how I ended up sort of finding performing, really.
And you found performing at Oxford, didn't you?
Yeah.
And famously, you were with the Review. And
yeah.
You worked with...
Stuart Lee was our director on that, and Richard Herring, and Armando Iannucci was sort of around when I first started doing stuff. Dave Schneider and...
What about Harry Hill? Did you meet him afterwards?
No, I met Harry in London in sort of 91, 92, when I was working on... Weekending, which was it's so long ago this now. BBC used to have a topical satire show once a week on a Friday night, and they had on Radio 4, and they had an actual open house commissioning process. So you'd turn up on the Wednesday or the Tuesday, I can't remember, at like 11 o'clock, and the producer would be sat there, and anyone could come into the building and pitch. And if you did well on that, if you got stuff picked up enough, got it into the programme, then you become a commissioned writer. And that was their pipeline for all sorts of people. Loads of people went through there. So I met Harry on that, and you could probably actually accurately date when I met him, because it was when it was the first Leaves on the Line story about British Rail.
The Pub Landlord was essentially your... a sort of slight off-the-cuff thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was because we were doing a show called Pub International, where we had a band, and Harry sang, I played the drums, and his old medical school pal, a guy called Matt Bradstock Smith, who's no longer with us, sadly, he played keyboards, and we had a musical bit at the end of this show, and Harry would do some stand-up, and I was meant to link it all, and I'd come up with a thing when we previewed it in London that didn't work. Just didn't work. And I'd written all this stuff, it just didn't work, and I couldn't make it work. Couldn't make it fire at all. And so by the time we got to Edinburgh, I still hadn't really got my head around what I was gonna do. And the first night in the cabaret bar at the Pleasance in Edinburgh, I said, well, why don't we say that the compere's not shown up and the barman's offered to fill in? And Harry's kind of like, yeah, whatever. You know, another one of your brilliant ideas. And so that then turned into the act.
And it became this huge success, and still is. And we should say, you're touring at the moment with the Pub Landlord.
Yes, we're on tour. Yeah, Gov Island is the name of the show.
Yeah.
So, classic vague title in order to not paint myself into a corner with... You know, some people, they give their show these titles, you think, yeah, but now you're going to have to do that. So it's the opposite of my book pitching thing, where I have no firm idea. I've got a nice loose title, funny poster.
You're presumably so confident in that character now, Al, that is it very easy for you to sort of slip into it? For example, when you're at a theatre and you're about to go on, do you have to get yourself into that mindset?
There is zero ritual. I travel very light in performance terms. So I did this play last year, The Crown Jewels in the West End, with Simon Nye wrote, it's his first play, and Sean Foley directed it, who I worked with on the Spitting Image show last year as well. And Neil Morrissey was in it, it was brilliant. Mel Gaudreau, I'm going to miss some people out. Carrie Hope Fletcher, Joe Thomas, Aidan McCardle.
It's like he's doing the Oscar speech. I don't want to miss people out.
Well, it was really, really, it was such an interesting experience, because some of the actors, they learn their lines and they go away, they learn their lines, they come back, they learn their lines, and they do it the same every time.
Yeah.
And some of the other actors are really, they really are chewing through what this line means, why does this scene... You know, what do I need to do? What am I what am I after? You know, what does my character want in this scene? All that sort of stuff.
They're doing that. What's the guy in Succession called?
Jeremy Strong.
They're doing a Jeremy Strong, because he famously is quite method, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so there was none of that. There was none of that from me. I'm just thinking, How do I learn my lines? And, you know, some people would need... and they're all brilliant. There's no vestige of sort of criticism or piss taking this. They're all brilliant at it. But it's, you know, some people really thinking about the energy on stage and where I fit in. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, I have to stand over there now.
Yeah.
So, and do these lines. And I'm going to try not to rush them.
So then you have more of a transactional approach in some ways?
I think so. But the thing about doing stand-up is to be serious about it for a minute, you really have to be in the moment. You have to be absolutely in the moment. You cannot be anywhere else when you're doing it. You can't have half a mind to something else. You can't be half uncommitted. You have to be completely in the moment. Obviously, you've picked the moment, you've decided the moment, you've shaped the moment, but you have to occupy it completely. And that's the thing that is still amazing about it for me as a thing to do. The thing I still find so incredibly exciting is that.
Is it where you're happiest, Al?
I think probably, and I think most comics that is the case. That's why you would. You know, go around the M25, you know, 1,000 times in 5 years.
You would, but that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Because I do think we're obviously at a different stage now with stand-up. Yeah. And a lot of the comics that I know, yourself, Lee Mack, yeah, Frank Skinner, you've all done that. You did your time. I'm sort of aware of comics, I suppose, fast-tracking a bit more.
Yeah.
And... because of social media, I presume. Yeah. How do you feel about that? And it, without judging them, obviously, because, you know, who's to say everyone wouldn't have done it if you were starting out now. But how do you think that was very valuable to you, that experience? And do you think in some ways you're not getting those knockbacks and that resilience?
That's a really good question, because you know, there's the urge in me that think that the guy who's done the miles and all that, you sort of think, you know, these youngsters, they don't know what they're doing, and it didn't do them any harm, and, you know, the 10,000 hours and all that. And you do... The thing is though, it's always been changing, it's always been shifting. I mean, that's doing all the history I do, the one consistent thing ever is change. You know, the old soldier in me thinks, well, yeah, but can you do it at midnight and all that sort of thing. But then I'm always finding things I can't do that I don't have a skill set for, even having done this all this time.
For example, you couldn't go on Instagram and say, hey, guys, I'm going to talk about a collab I'm doing.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. I'm really fortunate people still want to come and see me. This tour is going extraordinarily well. There's still people who come all over the country to see me. So I'm not not going to get too tangled up in wondering if whose grass is green or if there is even is there any greener grass, you know.
Well, the pub landlord, who was this sort of slightly bizarre fringe character on the edges of society, now seems to essentially be reflecting the current political climate.
Well, I know. I mean, this is a thing.
It's your fault, Al.
Well, I have had people tell me that on social media. It's you, by mocking it, made it all acceptable. Like, well,
have they seriously said that?
I've had the odd couple of people pop up and say part of the normalisation process of, like, well, you know, sorry. I was doing my jokes, you know.
I really hope you loved part one of this week's Walking the Dog. If you want to hear the second part of our chat, it'll be out on Thursday. So whatever you do, don't miss it. And remember to subscribe so you can join us on our walks every week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.